Welcome to the Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, computer techie wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And episode 34, that's where we are. Now we're all back, all three of us. Since the last episode, all three of us has met up at Og Camp in Liverpool. So a good time was had by all. I only got over there on the Friday night, but the actual event was on for the whole weekend. So we'll have to go over to Jerry and Al to fill us in about what went on and who met who and things like that. But it sounds like you all had a good time.
Yeah, we seem to meet quite a lot of people. And lots of talks went to see, really, and it was really good. I mean, we met some nice security people, and we got some more people to go on, hopefully some interesting podcasts to come on the show and talk about. It was a really good time.
When you say we met security people, you don't mean doormen, do you?
No.
Computer security people.
Yeah.
So we didn't have a close encounter with any bouncers, luckily.
All got chucked out.
But
yeah, someone came up to me and said, "Hang on, you're on that podcast." Mind you, we were wearing the our classic T-shirts, weren't we? So people came up and said, "Hang on, I know your podcast." It's actually good to know that people listen and recognise us and things like that, isn't it?
So
we do
yeah.
have listeners. Hey.
So me and Jerry will probably do a show on the HPR network that we did last year, just to recap of what we kind of who we met or what talked went and saw kind of thing, and the OVO, what pubs we ended up at and kind of thing, and the chats and stuff we had. So yeah, it was a really good weekend, really. We all got to meet up together. We all got the photo. We put in the show notes of us three meeting up all together in one place. So hopefully there'll be another Og Camp next year and we can all catch up again soon. So
yeah, they're always very non-committal about there being another Og Camp, but there has been one every year since whenever it was. 2011, was it?
I think so. So I had an interesting kind of week at work kind of thing. I've had an interesting thing with a cluster, which is kind of like a high availability solution. So you can cluster two computers together, and that can present you with a service or providing you, we're talking about Microsoft world here. We're talking about if you had in Hyper-V, you can have a highly availability cluster, which means you'd have two hosts and, or as a minimum, and on there you could have your virtual machines running on either of the hosts. And so it'd be load balancing. So you'd have some on your hosts on one host and some on the other host, on the physical host, a server. And if one of those servers dies, or if you want to take it down for maintenance, you can migrate the machines from one of those hosts to the other host. So if you migrate it, so like you want to take it down for like one of the hosts got a problem with a power supply or something, you can shut it down. Before you can shut it down, you can migrate those virtual machines from one host to the other host, then shut that host down, then fix it, and then bring it back, and then make the load again equal across the two. If one dies, like if it had a hardware failure, Windows will automatically bring that VM up on the other host. So if you've got two hosts, it'd bring it up on the second host, which hadn't failed. So with Windows clustering, you can do those things. You can have like DHCP, high availability, print cluster, DNS servers, lots of things you can cluster. A lot of people do file servers. But the one thing you do need for this to work is you have to have a shared storage so both of the machines can see this shared storage. And it's normally something like a SAN, which is a storage area network. And what that means is you have that's like a disk, and that's then presented to both of the servers, or however many servers you've got in the cluster. And there's normally three ways that can be presented to the cluster. One is by a fiber, which is like a fiber optics, and that goes, so that'd be done by fiber optic, like a, I can't think what they called that, fiber cable basically, and they go into a switch, and then each of the cards will have, each of the servers will have a fiber connector card in it. Normally you have like a dual path to everything, so normally you'd have a either two so from the sand you'd have like two controllers, so if a controller fails it will flip over the data, so it will flip all the data. The data comes from the other controller. So each controller would have a fiber connector into the fiber switches. And then from the fiber switches, you'd have two fiber switches. So if you had what fiber switch one, fiber switch two, controller one, controller two, you'd have a connection from controller one to the fiber switch. And then controller two would go to the fiber switch two. And then from your host, you'd have either two fiber cards, or you'd have two separate fiber cards, or a fiber card with two fiber ports in it. And then from each of those ports and those fiber cards, you'd have it going to switch one and switch two. So that means if whatever part of the network fails, you're still going to have access to the SAN. Other way you can do it is via network with iSCSI. Again, you'd have all the same sort of thing, residency, but it's just an over IP and then Ethernet. Or you can do it through serial attached SCSI, so that's SAS, so that's SAS, which normally means you can limited to having a maximum of two hosts can access that controller. So if you're not going to be expanding anything more than two hosts, you can use SAS. And interesting what this... To control all this in Hype in Microsoft, you have a thing called Failover Cluster Manager. And when a cluster comes up, there's like a node what basically grabs the disk and says, I'm the owner of that disk. And that owner will claim that disk. And if it's going to go for shutdown for some reason, like we said earlier, for but if you take it down for maintenance, it will change the ownership from itself to another host. And what will happen with is that if you have if it fails, the server will try and keep the other server, which isn't the owner, will basically keep trying to own that machine. So every couple of seconds they'll say, are you still the owner? Are you still the owner? Are you still the owner? If it does fail, they obviously the disk will go, are you the owner? Are you? And obviously the server won't reply that it's the owner. So it then grabs the disk. Okay. Does that all make sense? I think.
It does. Are you talking about Hyper-V or virtual machines? You mentioned virtual machines earlier.
Yeah, basically we're in to make highly available machines available in Windows using Hyper-V, you have to use the built-in Windows clustering feature, if you see what I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have the clustering in Windows, which is also you can also use for other things, like I said, like print sharing, high availability, DHCP servers, Win servers and stuff. But the main feature you're using it for these days is... highly available virtual machines. So if a virtual machine is on one host, okay, and that server dies, okay, it will go, oh, that server's, that host has now died. Those VMs have now gone offline because I'm in a cluster. I'm going to take ownership of those VMs and then bring them back online. So it's like someone pulled the power out of the back of those VMs, but they're basically they will be powered back on the other host.
So they're using the same sort of service as the other clustering stuff, the sort of other high availability stuff.
Yes.
So it's the same sort of thing that powers the Hyper-V VMs, if you like.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, got you.
And then what happened is that we had an upgrade happening on one of our customer sites, and someone did some updates to the firmware on the storage, and we did that. Well, I didn't, the person did it. And when they brought all the VMs back on, all the LUNs came back on. So the LUNs are the logical unit number devices which gets presented to the servers. And we could see the LUN in available to when you go into Disk Manager. But when you go into the file over Cluster Manager, it's moaning that it couldn't bring this disk online. So all they had five disks, and all four of the disks came along, but the fifth disk wouldn't come online. So whatever we tried, it would not come online. But I didn't want to start getting too in depth because I didn't really know that much in depth about on Hyper-V. If it was VMware, it'd been fine. But what happened, we had to get a peek to Microsoft. And what had happened is that the they basically removed the failed cluster disks from the failover manager. And then on the MSA, which is basically where this is the SAM, which is basically presenting the storage, we unpresented the LUN from all the hosts. So on the storage, you say on the MSA, I want these two hosts to have access to this storage. Okay, we did that, and we basically meant that the storage wasn't presented to the servers. We then, from then, checked that both the servers could not see the storage. Then on one of the hosts, we represented the storage back to one of the hosts, okay? But what had happened was we then rescanned that on the server which we represented to. But when the disk came back, it wasn't coming up as an NTFS disk. Normally when you do this, the LUN disk, you see it as an NTFS disk. It was just sitting there as raw. And what had happened was that there's apparently what I was telling you about who owns the disk, there's a thing called a PR field on the LUN, and that had basically got stuck because someone hadn't shut down the cluster properly. What you meant to do when you shut down the clusters, every host is meant to go down, and at the end of that, the PR field is cleared, but it hadn't been cleared. So they got the guy, the Microsoft guy, ran a command called cluster space node / clear PR one. I'll put the links in the show notes. And what that does is that basically clears that PR number. And then when you did a disk rescan inside Windows, it wasn't a raw disk, it was an NTFS disk that time, okay? And then we on the MSA, we presented it back to the LUN on the MSA to the other host. And we rescanned on the second host, and it could see the storage, and it says NTFS. And then in Failover Manager, we said, look, here's a disk back online, bring the server line back online. Boom, we could see that disk online. And then it basically, we could then bring the VM back up. So something to keep in the back of your mind. I'll put the links in the show notes to that. So yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one.
So, is that your new job?
Yes. So, yeah, it was good. And the other thing about my job is, if people don't know, I've moved jobs as well. It's not long as Jerry moving job, I've moved jobs as well. And they use RMM product for everything. So, an RMM product is a remote monitoring and management product. So, every server they look after or PC they look after has got this client on it. And it sits in the tray. It's a bit like GFI Max. And it basically, every couple of seconds, it reports back to the server saying if the antivirus is up to date, if there's any errors on there, or anything like that. And then if you want to remote control a PC, you can just go into this one console and you can right-click this icon and say connect to the computer. And then you connect to the computer with the console. You can help the user, or you can connect to the server. And you can also do things like if it notices that space is getting low, it will auto-generate a ticket for you and put that into our ticketing help desk system. So it's all very clever stuff. I just remember
that sounds clever, doesn't it? Yeah. Less firefighting, I think.
Yes. So that's been my interesting week. What about you guys?
Well, I've... I've just started a new job as well. As you alluded to earlier, Al. It seems to be a little bit going away from the sort of traditional sysadmin kind of role that I've been doing up until this point, which I've been doing for about the last 15 years, actually. But I think I mentioned it last episode. It's my job title is operations developer now, so I think they're going to expect me to do some actual coding, which is a little bit scary. But I suppose it's more scripting than coding. I think it's going to be sort of Python and Ruby. But it'll be interesting. It's all new stuff, which is interesting. Stops me getting bored. So the first thing that I was looking at is a thing called Terraform. Now, what it is, it's to go to start from the basics. It controls AWS. Now, AWS is Amazon Web Services, and they've got probably about 30 or 40 different services that they offer to the general public. Basically, infrastructure as a service. So instead of going out and buying a server and putting it in a data center and everything, you just say, I would like a server, or I would like a database or some storage, and Amazon will provide that to you by the hour, and charge you for it. So that's what a lot of companies use to get their web apps and things off the ground. So that's the kind of company I'm working for. They're building a service, a web service, and mobile service, and they're using AWS to do it. Now, Terraform is a way of configuring those services in code. So you basically code the way that you want your infrastructure to work, press the button, then it brings all the stuff up as you've configured it. And from what I can see, it's pretty powerful, it's pretty good. But it's all new, so I've spent the last 4 days finding out all this stuff, or being told this stuff by a very nice Kiwi guy. But it's all a bit full on. My brain hurts a bit, so maybe I can come back and provide some more detail on that in future episodes. But I'll have to let it all soak in first.
So is that
along
like
the way,
learning command
what's that,
lines
sorry?
and things like that? Is it like learning new command lines and different?
What?
Is it anything like C++, or is it anything like Visual Basic or anything like that? Or
not really. It's more like learning a new sort of programming language, but it's a bit like it's a bit like the Puppet program. Not exactly a programming language, but it's that's what it reminds me of. You sort of put things in modules, and you have to think about things like in things inheriting other things, and that sort of thing, and the scope of variables and things like that. It's probably doesn't work very well on in audio. So, but I can, once I've got my head around it a bit more, I can probably do a bit more of an overview for the listener, and make a bit more sense.
So,
as it is,
is it a scripting language then? So you basically say, I want five servers or whatever for this project, and it goes away and creates you five servers for you, kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. But with AWS, you before you even get a server up, you've got to configure all the networking,
okay,
and things like so a VPC is a like a private network within your infrastructure, and you've got I'm just trying to think now, security groups, which are like a firewall that you can apply to various bits,
okay,
like your your database servers or your web servers or whatever, subnet groups and things like that. So yeah, it's all fairly complex, and it took me, I mean, just the networking bit alone took me a day or so, or took this guy teaching me a day or so before we even brought up a VM. So but the thing is, because it's all in code, you don't have to click around the interface. It talks directly to the API. And once it's there, so kind of once you've got the code, you can just apply it, you know, in different situations. So yeah, so that's been kind of my week. Also learned a bit more about Vim, the famous Linux, Unix text editor. It turns out I've been using it just as a sort of text editor, but you can do a lot more with it. There's plugins you can get for it. There's one particularly good one is NerdTree. It's called NerdTree, and it basically gives you a file system tree in Vim, so you can go to the file that you want and just press return, and it comes up in a different window.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. But it's meant learning a lot of keyboard shortcuts, and that's been made more difficult again by the fact that the computer I've got, with, you know, that they've been good enough to supply me with, is a Mac. So all the keys are in all different places. So which is not good when you're learning lots of keyboard shortcuts. So now I'm sitting here at my PC, and it's got all the keys in the right place. It's lovely, and they're all the right size. So that's my week. It's a bit confusing, a bit befuddling, but interesting, and I'm sure I'll get the hang of it. I hope I do, anyway.
Yeah, sure do. Yeah, I mean, it's like that with anything new, isn't it? It's just getting the hang of it. In a couple of weeks, you'll be teaching everyone else how to do it.
So
I hope so, yeah.
So has someone been teaching at the company, currently works at the company, or was it like an outsourcing person to come in, or was it like a person who's taking?
Well, what it is this company that I've joined are pretty new, but all the stuff has been set up by an agency, and they've got the people in there that have been doing this stuff for ages, and which is this an example of, which is the guy that's teaching me, and so they've set up this thing and basically handed it over to us. Well, it was us, you know, I've only been there a week. But and it's going to be my job to support it. So he's half teaching me the stuff that I don't know, which is a lot of AWS, because I knew a bit, but I didn't know very much, and half teaching me how they've actually configured the stuff. So that's why it's quite full on, I think.
Cool. Andy, what about you?
I've got a couple of things. This week, one of them's at one of the places I've mentioned them before. It's one though, you put a gigabit network and a gigabit NAS into there.
Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, so well, basically it's a bit of an expansion on that. They've now got access to these additional rooms, and they want to start putting computers in. At the minute, all of the computers that they're running the business from, and printers, are all in one room, and it's kind of crowded in there, really. Yeah. With the amount of desks and the people, and then there's printers all over the place, and then the trouble is, you see someone, you know, phones up, and you got two people on the phone at the same time, and they're both trying to hear each other, so they're going to separate out into these different rooms, so you can have a bit more privacy, I suppose. So he asked me to go over and have a look and see what we could do about actually getting some kind of cabling in there. and things like that. So went over and had a look, went into the next room, and then went into this utterly other rooms upstairs as well. I'm having a look around, and I said, hang on, there are Ethernet ports on the wall here. So he said, oh, is that what they are? So I said, yeah, they're Ethernet ports. And they were numbered as well, quite handily. So we then went to try and figure out.
That usually means there's a patch panel somewhere or a comms
room. Well, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so we found 12 all numbered up. And then right next to number 3 and 4 was in a, looked like an additional 13, 14, and 15, and 16, which must have been added in at a later date. Now, actually, we'll come back to that bit because they become a little bit of a problem. So we found all of these sockets on the wall, and then we just had to find out where they went back to. So I said that there'd be some kind of panel or something somewhere in the building at least. So we kind of had a wander around. And while I was upstairs, I could look through one of the windows upstairs. It's like an internal window. And I could actually see a cabling tray running against the wall. And I thought, that looks like it's got a load of Ethernet cables on, so let's follow that. We ended up going into this storeroom, which I didn't know existed at all until this point. Went into this storeroom and then saw a big, a very wide piece of trunking coming down the wall. We then had to move a load of their equipment that they've got. So there's lots of lifting gear and lots of pumps and drills and all sorts of stuff. We had to shift a load of this stuff off the racking. And there was a big pile of Ethernet cables all coming down. We've got some pictures that I have put on Google Plus already, but we'll put them on the show notes as well. Unfortunately, they don't come down to a nice little patch panel. Instead of being terminated in the back of a patch panel, they're terminated directly into RJ45 plugs. So it's not exactly ideal in terms of that, but okay, fair enough, it works. So I actually got, I posted a picture of this as well on Google Plus and Facebook of this little network tester. It's a really, really old network tester that I've still got. It actually has token ring tester and BNC sockets on it as well. That's how old it is. but all I did is shoved a battery in it. I just wanted to check if these cables were still, good and if they were going back to the place where we thought they were going back to. So I know there are much more sophisticated ones nowadays, but plugged one in one end. I plugged one at the other end. And there's 8 lights on it for each core of the cable, and they all flickered, so I thought that was great. So they all go back to the same place. Now beforehand they only had an 8 port gigabit switch. That's all they needed at the time, but with them wanted to expand into all these other ones, and now we found out that they all go back to this one location. Then we said, right, what we should do is put we're now going for a 24 port gigabit switch. Plenty of room for expansion because they're only going to be using 16 ports of it at the moment anyway. That should be good enough for now, plus they can have 8 more if they needed it. So we got them the gigabit switch, and I went this last week to get it all plugged in and changed over in that. But progress was slightly halted because when I actually went to plug them in, I basically figured out, I thought, hang on a minute, there's only 12 cables coming down here. Where's these 13, 14, 15, and 16, which look like additional ones that had put in at a later date at some point. So again, we went through the same process to find out where those cables were, because they weren't coming out where these big 12 grey cables were coming out. When I took the faceplates off these additional ones, and I then noticed that they were yellow yellow Cat 5 cables. So I was then looking for some yellow cables. And when I followed the cable tray back, they appeared to go to exactly the same place as the other 12. But they were nowhere to be seen. Until I took the trunking off, the trunking lid off, only to find four yellow cables cut back, literally cut off, and shoved back in the trunking again. Now, this is not good at all. So I don't know why or who's cut them off and hid them in the trunking. And the other thing about them as well is they're too short because they've been cut off. So we've now got to reposition where we're going to put the switch, because I don't think he's going to pull in four new cables because it's quite a long run. So we're now going to have to reposition where we put the switch. I'm going to have to take those cables out and then re-terminate them again. I've got some of those pictures as well somewhere for those additional ones, which we can put into the notes if anyone wants to look at that. So that's that particular job. So it kind of came to a grinding halt at that point, because I didn't have any terminator tools or any wire cutters or anything like that on me at the time. I'm actually going back on Monday, just a few days after this, after we're recording this podcast, to just crack on with a bit more. I'm going to go over my terminating tool and try and get these extra ones all up and running again. Then we'll have 16 ports all ready to go. Then we can plug them into this switch and get everything going again. I was also going to put the NAS drive that they have is currently in the main office. And as I said to him, I said it doesn't have to be in there. It's just taking up space in there. So I said we'll put the NAS drive in there as well. Another thing he's doing as well is he's making up I left him to this actually last time I saw him. He's making up some kind of cabinet or something like that for this switch to go into, just to protect it, because there are lots of heavy gear in that room, so it could easily get, you know, knocked off or smashed or whatever. So we're going to put it in some kind of cabinet so it's a bit safe. The other thing I found as well is, and I'll have to redo this with the terminating tool I've got, is on one of the cables, the third core, I'm not getting a signal from one end to the other, so it might be a bad connection or a connection just come loose or whatever, so I've got to check that out again. But otherwise, once all that's reconnected, it should be good to go.
Is this the company that you redid their network and a diagram, yep, on the previous show?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So, actually, yeah. It's not. Yeah, it's the diagram that we've posted before. It's kind of like it's the same company, but it's a different franchise of the same company in a different place. Right. But it's basically the same, you know, basically the same layout. Yeah. So
I was going to say, it sounds like they're expanding, maybe as a direct result of your intervention, mm-hmm, you know, your technical expertise.
Yeah. he does keep mentioning, and I think this is, it's one of those situations, you know, of doing a job for somebody. I actually did it initially for the other franchise, and seeing what a difference it made. And that's why this guy wanted his doing the same. And then since then, you know, things have gone much better for him. I don't know if it's a direct result of making a quicker network, but it's certainly the original network that we did was so slow. It was unbelievable. You know,
I mean, if it improves how they work, then, you know, if they're spending, say, 5 minutes to do something, so 20, then it's got to be better for their business, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and he sees that, definitely. You know, he's mentioned it a few times. You know, but in the other place, you know, you could be, it sounds ridiculous, but you could wait, you know, 20 minutes to transfer a gigabyte file from the so-called file server onto your computer. you know, via the network, because at that point it was a shared USB 2 via a network on a slow PC to another slow PC on a 100 meg network. And then when we put the gigabit switch in and the gigabit NAS drive in, you know, you could transfer that gigabyte file from one machine to the other in about 20 seconds or something, you know.
Yeah.
So they're absolutely gobsmacked.
It just goes to show when you've got decent infrastructure, you know, how much it can improve things. Cause
it doesn't really cost that much, does it? No.
No.
I mean, that switch that I got for them there is, I think it was £80 or something like that, £70 or £80.
Hmm.
You know, it's a TP-Link, 24-port. It's either desktop or rack-mounted switch. You know, it's not managed. It's not a managed switch in any way. It's just a basic switch, you know. So, but yeah. So the next podcast, I can follow up on that and let you know how it went. So, and a couple of other things that I've been looking into and kind of thought I'd bring up in this is, I've recently transferred my PC, main PC, to an i5, which I'm using right now, which has got 16 gig on board, which is significantly more than I had beforehand. and as a consequence of that, I've been trying to make use of VirtualBox in a much better way. You know, being able to assign more memory and more processors to the different virtual boxes and that. So I've been having a bit of a play with Ubuntu as well this week, as a dual core 4 gig virtual box machine. And it runs really well. But one of the things I wanted to mention, I don't know if anyone's had this before, is I was looking into this operating system, I suppose it is, which is called FreeNAS. I think the idea of it is it's a Linux, definitely Linux based free operating system, which runs on a PC, I assume, rather than
think it's actually,
a NAS drive.
I think it's actually Open Solaris rather than Linux, so similar, okay. but not the same.
It's BSD.
So, it used to be Solaris, I think.
Yeah, SDFX used to, SDFS used to come, isn't it? With what it was derived from. But FreeNAS is owned by the people who create it, the people who do those servers, IX system, which basically it's the back end of a thing called the SDFS system, which is like a FreeNAS is like a GUI front end for it. So go ahead, Andy.
Yeah. Oh, good, yeah. So, well, I thought that could be a little project just to have a play about with. So if I got an old tower and put FreeNAS on it and just run it and see how it goes, you know. So, but before I did that, I tried to run it in, tried to load it in VirtualBox. But I'm having trouble loading it in VirtualBox. It won't even install. It's not the running of it. It's the installation of it. So in VirtualBox, you boot up a new machine, and then point it to an ISO. So I had to download this ISO. It's a good few hundred meg ISO. So I tried to install it from the ISO file, and the first thing it says is, you might be able to put some light on this situation. It says, your CPU does not implement AMD 64 architecture. Please load kernel first. And that's the only message you get.
I think what's happening there is, well, it doesn't believe that the virtual CPU in VirtualBox is a 64-bit processor.
Okay.
So I don't know if there's some tweaking you can do in VirtualBox, but it could be that it doesn't like being on a virtual CPU at all. And it
that's
will,
true, yeah.
Because it's designed to be like a NAS system, so you'll be putting it on a box that sits in the corner or whatever, just serving data. It might only work on bare metal, so if you've got
okay,
it's because
you don't.
You need to go into the BIOS, and there's this thing you need to enable called VT for it to work. There's a function
okay.
You need to do. There's probably two options. I can't remember to the top of my head, but what you can do is, if you've got the model of the chip, I can't believe an i5 is not a 64-bit machine. It's a 64, not a 64-bit processor.
It's definitely 64.
So yeah, there's
it's what VirtualBox is presenting to it, maybe, but you're probably right about the VT stuff.
Yeah, you have to go into BIOS, and there's two things you need to enable, basically. There's two options. Google is your friend. So, yeah. And the other thing is you can run it in a VirtualBox, because I run it in a VirtualBox, but it runs quite slowly because it needs quite a lot of RAM. And also, the idea of SIDFS is that it speaks directly to the hard drives. So what happens is that, let's say you've got three hard drives. I might be completely wrong about this, but it does a virtual RAID kind of thing over those three disks, and it speaks to the hard drives directly, and it knows if there's a problem with a hard drive, that it knows that it needs to copy that data to somewhere else. And if you're running it virtual, it can't. If it's running a virtual system, you can't do it, kind of thing. So
we can run this if I do the BIOS thing and I run this, and just to have a quick go of it. I mean, I wouldn't use it as a proper, a proper virtual machine for it, but ultimately, you'd need to do it in an actual tower itself.
Yes.
Is there any specific type of? Does it just mean any PC really, or does it? They need a PC with lots of RAM in it.
Yeah, RAM is the thing it needs for work, really. If you're not going to be doing anything like with D-Deep or anything, it probably run with a couple of gig of RAM and it's absolutely fine. So when you start doing things like D-Deep and stuff. And also, you don't need a RAID controller card. So like before, like I'm on the servers we normally supply, is we have something like with a RAID card in it. And that RAID card will do all the RAID for you. But what this does is you just have to plug the hard drives directly into the machine, and the software does the RAID for you.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, just going on from that, because, in fact, tonight, I got a phone call off someone tonight. They gave me this PowerEdge 6650 Dell server. Ages ago, to see if I had any customers that required it or anything like that. And so far, no one has. I've still got it. It's just sitting in the back room downstairs. And he phoned me up and he said, have you managed to sell it yet? I said, no. Nobody's wanted it. I've definitely needed parts and everything. So he just said, you might as well just keep it then. So I said, oh, great, yeah. Okay, no problem. So tonight I've acquired this PowerEdge 6650 server. Now, I know it's a Dell one, so you may not have particularly messed about with this one. But a question to have is what kind of things, considering I don't necessarily need it, but what kind of things could I do with it?
You could put FreeNAS on it.
There you go. It led into that nicely, didn't it? Yeah, but that is a good idea, isn't it? Although it's a very big NAS drive.
It's quite.
You can never have too much storage.
Yeah.
Is that a couple of U server as well?
Is that what? Sorry.
A couple of U. So the width of it, is it like a desktop or a rack mount server?
Oh, it's a rack mount.
Yeah.
It's massive.
Yeah. So that's
huge.
Yeah. I'm just having a good picture of it now. So.
Yeah. It is. It weighs a ton. I mean, ideally, you have to have two people to carry the thing. It really does weigh a ton. I'm not sure how many drives are in it, but I think it's got four or five drives.
Yeah, you could run it. But it'd probably be cheaper entirely to run it for a month to buy. So probably the amount of electric it's going to use, probably be cheaper to buy a new PC.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It has. Because it has no of these bigger servers. No, they've got the ones that have the different power plug at the back. For the kettle plug to plug into. It's not your standard kind of kettle plug. It's a different shape. So you can't plug anything else into it.
They're usually, with the Dell ones, they're modular, so you can actually swap out the power supply for a different one. But By the looks of it, it's a fairly old model, so I don't know if you'll be able to get
it's quite old
parts for it now.
Apparently, it's got server 2008 on it, or so something like that. It's also got a floppy disk drive on the front.
Wow.
Now, I don't know whether that's just for, you know, just in case you need it for something or other. But
I think that's probably the last model of a Dell server that came with a floppy disk.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and I've acquired that, but I still have. But I see the thing about the power that it'll consume. I'll have to take out another phase of electricity just to run the thing.
Yeah.
That's what the guy said to me. He said, "Do you want it?" You know, initially thinking, do I want to buy it off him? And I said, no, not really, no. And then he said, no, you can have it. I said, oh, right, okay. Yeah, fair enough. But, I mean, it's one of those things. I might, you know, be able to use it for, you know, if it's got some kind of Windows server on it, I can just use it for, you know, learning on, I suppose, can't I? Just boot it up every so often and mess about with it and break it and rebuild it and stuff like that, if anything, you know.
And then quickly turn it off again before your electricity bill gets too high.
Yeah. That's it. So, but yeah, that's the main things that I've been up to this week, and I'll get back to everyone about that cabling job next time I get over there. So,
yeah, interesting. Cool. You're talking about putting gigabit to the switch or whatever.
Yeah,
I've had a customer this week. He wants to have 10 gig to the desktop.
Oh, Jesus!
Yeah, I don't know how much
to do with that then.
Yeah, I don't know how much that's going to cost him. If it's even going to be worth doing it, kind of thing. So,
can you get 10 gig over Cat 5 these days?
I think you have to be Cat 6 for it to work.
Right.
I haven't even looked into it yet. Cat 5e. Yeah.
Yeah.
That being said,
what are they planning to do with it?
Well, they're basically a drawing company. They do lots of drawing and designing furniture, and they're just moaning that the network's slow. But I don't think it's a network at all. I think it's their old server, what they've got, which is like 5 years old. So,
get some SSDs in there.
Yeah,
see how that goes.
Make a big difference. Yeah, I mean, if they're running a gigabit network, and it's like a bottleneck, isn't it? It only needs one slow bit to slow everything down, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, or more than one person accessing the server at the same time. If you've got spinning disks, unless you've got, you know, big RAID array, that it could be potentially be quite slow. But SSDs, it's just random access, isn't it? So, which they're really good at. So.
And if you fill them with SSDs instead of spinning disks, that would cost a fair bit as well. Depends on the size that they have.
Yeah, although SSDs are getting a lot cheaper these days, I've noticed.
One of my customers got a terabyte one for about $320 a couple of weeks ago.
Right. My new MacBook has got a half gig, a half terabyte.
500 gig. Yeah.
They're
not too bad, but it's like the thing. It's like logarithmic in terms of pricing, isn't it? With these things, you know, the really cheap ones. You know, it's a bit like, you know, even CPUs or graphics cards or whatever. The really cheap ones. So say you've got a 50 quid graphics card or something. You know, they're fine. You know, and then a 100 quid one is miles better than that. You know, but a 200 quid one is just a bit better than that. You know. And then you can get to the 300 quid and the, you know, 300 quid. So not that much better, but they are a bit better, you know.
I was looking at mice today as well. Computer mice, not the... Not
are you
the,
gonna bend down to pets breeding at home?
Yeah. On Amazon. And you can pay up to a couple of hundred quid for a mouse these days.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. Like the cheap ones are less than a tenner. And the most expensive one that I saw was, I think, 250 quid. It's ridiculous.
One of my customers got a mouse, and that was £70. It was like a gaming mouse.
Yeah.
And I thought that was
some
a lot.
Of those gaming mice. Some of those gaming mice look really freaky, don't they? They don't look comfortable to me. They don't look ergonomic at all.
I've used it, you know, and it's I don't like it. And you can even do things like they come with little weights, so you can pop the back off and you can put different amount of weights in them and stuff like that. So you can weight the mouse to your own thing. and then, of course, there's buttons on the side and on the top, and, you know, there's just loads of buttons on it for that you can program for the game.
The few times I've used a mouse with the buttons on the side, I kept hitting them, and I think by default they're set to go backwards and forwards in your browser. So it was really annoying. It's like you grip the mouse and you're suddenly on a different web page.
Yeah.
I need to get a new laptop case as well. A new laptop rucksack, because my one's gone back, so I need to kind of have a look for what the best kind of option is for those.
I've got a pretty good one, which I got when I knew I was going to be leaving my old employer, because they supplied me with my rucksack. I got a new one, so I'll send it to you. I'll put it in the show notes.
Right. Do you have an odd camp or not? Is it a different one?
Yes, the one I had at odd camp, yeah.
Cool.
We've had some mail, haven't we?
The electronic type, yes.
Yes. Not snail mail, electronic mail.
Electronic mail. Well, we've never given out our PO box, have we? So no one can send us letters. We have. Let's have a look. We've got them in our notes. Okay. I'll read out the first one if you want.
Okay.
Okay. So this is from Brad Torrey. I've heard him loads of times on different podcasts, so it's good to know that he listens to ours as well. So anyway, he says, still love the show, guys. I was listening to the latest episode and wanted to share a bit of WordPress. We've been getting hit with a lot of WordPress attacks lately. From what I've seen, you're right on. Almost all of the WordPress files don't change unless you've gone and modified them manually. The WP content folder is the one exception. You'd want to be careful with that folder. But if you have to source the files from WordPress and the source from the plugin, you can overwrite most files safely. We follow your method of saving the files by changing the name before restoring it too. Also, WordFence is a useful plugin that helps with security. We've set it to block IPs when someone tries to log in with a username that doesn't exist, etc. For automating maintenance, you could create a lot of scheduled tasks, but it's probably easier and more effective to use an RMM to monitor alert and schedule tasks, either by schedule or when something triggers a need. Enable is good, but a little pricey to get started. We're looking at the Ninja, and there's always max focus. For backups, we run scheduled backups using the utility built in to the NAS on site, either QNAP or Synology. And then the NAS has a schedule off to an off-site backup, either to another NAS or to a service like Amazon. We support small and medium businesses, so we don't have Active Directory or a large budget usually. So these methods work for us. I enjoyed the commentary on these topics, and I'm taking some of the suggestions and applying them to our systems. Thanks for the great podcast, and that's from Brad. So that comes from that WordPress problem I had, wasn't it? Which was the taxonomy.php file that's corrupt in some way, and what I did is I took downloaded the WordPress from the zip file from the WordPress site itself, found that file and uploaded it manually, and then that fixed the problem. So it sounds like he does the same same sort of method when they have that when they have that kind of problem. So so yeah, thanks for that email, Brad, and it's good to know that you're listening to the show.
Yeah, I actually saw another couple of approaches which might work for the WordPress thing. One of them is to use Git, so you make the WordPress web files into a Git repository, put the it's a bit technical, but the .git file, which is what basically describes your Git repository, make sure that's somewhere out of the web root, so anyone coming to the website has got no access to it, and then it's really easy to see what files have changed. So that might be an option as well. So some people were on the mailing list I'm on were throwing some ideas around. Maybe I could follow up on that next time. Brad also mentions that an RMM, which Al was mentioning earlier.
Cool. Thanks for emailing in. We like to hear from emails.
Yeah. And we had another one from John the Nice Guy, didn't we?
Yes, who we met at OrCamp, and hopefully going to get on the show to talk about networking.
Did you meet him?
No, he wasn't at the pub on the Friday night.
Shall I read out his mail? Yeah, he met you, so you can read out.
Okay, he says, hey there, podcast people. Great to meet you guys at OrCamp. I hope to see you both again at Stuff in the future. Well, if there's another OrCamp, we'll be there. on the show, you mentioned that you were using the kill command to get a progress update in DD. Well, how about using DCFLDD instead? You can tell it to show how far through the process it is. It's really nice and can be configured not to die when it fails to read a sector as well. All the best, John. Now, I had a quick look at this before we came on, and yeah, it's true, it does. It shows you progress, and you can do all sorts of other stuff with it that you can't do with the standard DD. So, give that a look. I couldn't find it in CentOS standard repositories, but it's definitely in Debian. Yet another reason to install Debian over CentOS. give that a go.
Cool. We'll put the notes in the show notes. So
yeah, I'll put an example command in the show notes as well.
Cool. I think we're just about another hour, aren't we, guys?
I think so.
About that, we're getting there.
Cool. So thanks for everyone listening again. And you can email us at mail@admin-podcast.co.uk or check out our website, www.admin-podcast.co.uk, and we've got all the links to the social media sites on it. So we'll speak to everyone soon.
See everyone.
Bye.
Bye.